when I lived in Be'er Sheva back in the 1980s, so the late chief rabbi, Rabbi Eliyahu Katz, so he once made a comment that Chag Sameach is to be said on a day that there are korbanot, on Yom Tov, on Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, there are korbanot. And then my reaction to him was, he was trying to say that on Yom Ha'atzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, we should have some other word, not Chag Sameach. And I explained to him, I said, I think we offered many, many korbanot for both Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, that it is appropriate to say Chag Sameach, and this is the way I conduct myself today. When I lived in Ramot for 22 years, so we had for many years in our community, and then later moved to Ramot Bet, an artist from hailing from Britain, but very, very much here in Israel for so many years, Archie Granot. He does paper cuts. Yeah, he does paper cuts. He used to have a gallery on Rehov Agron that closed down a few years ago, but he still does exhibitions, and he has absolutely beautiful works, and I can attest to it because I actually did the weddings for two of his kids, and I just see it as a schut. I don't see it as a profession. So I don't expect anything in return. But sometimes people give a gift, whatever. So, you know, it says, Sonei matanot yichyeh. It's pasuk in Mishlei. You should, somebody who hates gifts, you know, will live longer. It's a comment by Shlomo HaMelech, you know, that they shy away from gifts. But in Yiddish, it's read, Sheina matonus yichyeh. If the matana is nice, this is a sheina matana, so that you're allowed to accept. And yichyeh. Yafeh, okay, I was corrected. So, this is yes, this you're allowed to. So Archie Granot presented me twice with his original works. One was so original, you know, he also has a number on it. This is the first, 25th of, let's say, a series of 100. So, beside that, whatever it is. But I have one that says 1/1. It's the only one that he did, and it was personal, highly personal. And it says, Havei mi talmidav shel Aharon, Ohev shalom, Rodev shalom, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, and it was given to me as a gift. But he also gave me the gift of the 70 names of Am Yisrael, and that many other people have as well. If you look at source number one on top, from Bamidbar Rabbah, from the Medrash, on this week's parasha, there are no more pages? Sorry. So maybe if somebody wants to... I thought I had enough. Yeah, thank you. This coming week, here in Eretz Yisrael, we read Parshat Naso. If for the unfortunates who are not here, they're in Chutz Laaretz, so they're going to read Parshat Bamidbar because they're off by a week because of Pesach, and that's going to be made up by Parshiot, Matot, and Masei. But Parshat Naso has the 12 Nisi'im, the printed heads of the Shvatim, bringing their korban of the at the inauguration of the Mishkan. It's a Balkairish dream because it's the same trup, the same tamim, 12 times over. All the name changes. The name of the Sheva changes. But there the Medrash goes to town explaining the numerical value of those coins that are mentioned. It says, Shivim Shekel B'Shekel HaKodesh. So what's significant about the number 70? Now 70 shows up in the Torah often enough. There are 70 Skenim, the concept of Sanhedrin, Esfali Shivimish, Mizikne Yisrael. So 70 is a number that we are familiar with. So the Medrash says that it reflects upon 70 names, as the Medrash says here, Davar Acher, Dalar Aleph, means this is another explanation of why it's Shivim Shekel. Keneged Shivim Shemot Sheyesh Lo LaKadosh Baruch Hu. God has 70 names, which means you're going to have to flush it out of Tanakh, and maybe even through statements of Chazal, to see all kinds of nicknames. So we're familiar with the 7 names that you're not allowed to erase, and then there are other nicknames, Kinuyim, and so on. So apparently it goes up to the number 70. And then it says, Shivim Shemot Sheyesh LiYisrael. Am Yisrael has 70 names. So on this Medrash, Archie Granot made his 70 names of Am Yisrael, which the background is a mirror. And in the middle it says Yisrael, and then around it you have the 70 names. So when you look at the picture, you see yourself. And the idea is, you are part of this picture. It's a very, very, very good idea. And then the next one was Shivim Shemot LeTorah, and the last was Shivim Shemot LeYerushalayim. So I remember Archie telling me that he wanted to do an integrated in Hebrew we call it Megzeret Niyar, the paper cut, of both the 70 names of God, 70 names of Shulayim, 70 names of Am Yisrael. That it just didn't work. It was too complicated. So he made three different pictures. So he has the picture of 70 names of Am Yisrael that I have in my house, 70 names of Yerushalayim, and 70 names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. These are three different pictures. What I was able to just lift out of the internet, and it just lacks the glamour and color, is what you have here on the page. This is Archer Ganot's version of where it says Yerushalayim in the middle, and it starts on top and to the bottom, the various names of Yerushalayim. What I did discover is that it's not uniform. There are differences of opinion as to what are the 70 names of Yerushalayim. On most of the lists, most of the names are identical, but here and there, there are some differences. If you open up a Siddur in the second day of Sukkot, in Hoshana, so it all goes by Aleph Bet, and Aleph Bet is 22. You have the 22 names of Yerushalayim. It begins with Even Shtiya, Beit HaPchira, Goren HaOrnan, Dvir HaMutzna, and so on. And I'll comment about some of them. Most of them are found in this paper cut of Archer Granot. But the question is, what did Chazal mean when they say that there are 70 names to Yerushalayim? It's almost what we say, Shivim Panim LaTorah, that there are 70 ways of analyzing a pasuk. Why are there 70 ways to analyze a pasuk? Why isn't there just one way to analyze a pasuk? It actually demonstrates that there is elasticity to Torah. There is openness. There is involvement. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Am Yisrael to be a participant in the process called Matan Torah. So it's not just a frozen, solid piece of law and narrative, but it goes with the Torah Shebaal Peh, and when it was Baal Peh, when it was oral, that means it's left open to discussion, to interpretation, and we become partner to that whole process. So it's true that if left unchecked, you would have what we call in this country, balagan. Everybody would be doing their own thing. And that's not what the halacha intended. And therefore, we have a Sanhedrin, which also has 70 members, 71 officially, but 70 is the number in the Chumash, to vote in each generation and lock in exactly what we should be doing. But those other interpretations are still regarded as Torah. They're not thrown in the geniza. They're not thrown in the garbage. They are Torah thoughts that under certain circumstances can be applied. Even if you take the contemporary situation, which is based on the Mishnah and the Gemara, and we don't have a Sanhedrin. So the Mishnah gives us different opinions on halakha, and the Gemara gives us different opinions, and then we work our way to the medievals, to the poskim, and they have different opinions. We all know the different opinions. I taught my students in Chashmonaim, if somebody asks you a halakha question, just say machloket, and you're going to be right. 99% you're going to be right. So you just hope he doesn't ask you between whom. Then you're in trouble. But if you say machloket, you're doing good. Because that really is the core, the ability to offer different suggestions. So if you take Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, so everybody knows that on there, this consensus that in general, we decide like Beit Hillel. Does that mean if you just read a Mishnah of Beit Shammai, you don't have to say Birkat HaTorah? Of course you have to say Birkat HaTorah. It's no less Torah than Beit Hillel. The question is, practically, do we do this or we do that? So that's an issue of practicality. But in terms of the theory of Torah, it remains Torah. I'll give you even a stronger example. I have a daughter, my oldest daughter, Ahuva, has a doctorate from Bar-Ilan in the history of philosophy and science. And she has a particular expertise in Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, Gersanides, as it's known in English. And that's only if you're into astronomy, because there is a crater on the moon named in his honor. Yeah, and it was a shame that Breshit, our satellite, didn't land there, because there it would have made a nice, comfortable landing instead of the Sea of Tranquility where it crashed. It wasn't so tranquil, but in the Ralbag's crater. Ah, so why does the Ralbag become a name of a crater? Because the astronomers recognize his greatness in astronomy. So he was a known scientist, and my daughter uses a book that he wrote on zoology, and she demonstrates that he uses psukim to back up his scientific knowledge, and when he writes parshanut, there's Ralbag on the Torah and on Nevi'im, he uses science to augment his perush. And she discovers that he's barking up the same tree. He's in the same frequency when he's a scientist and he's a parshan. So I asked my daughter a simple question. Do you have any perushim that Ralbag uses based on science that we know today is not true, empirically not true? I mean, this is all before Copernicus and so on. So my daughter says, yes, there are psukim. So I said, what do you do about that? Here you have one of the great Rishonim giving an explanation to a pasuk in Tehillim, in Mishlei, wherever, and it's based on a scientific idea that's wrong. So my daughter says, the first thing you do is you say Birkat HaTorah when you read the Ralbag, because she said it's a Heftzah Shel Torah, it's a piece of Torah. When he wrote it, it was Torah. Now you have to discuss, what are we going to do about this? She believes Ralbag, if he would understand science as we understand today, he would revise the pshat. That's what he would do. Or he would break his head and try to understand the scientific idea differently. But he would do something about it. In other words, he was honest. He wouldn't say, nah, they're all not, they don't know anything. I have the truth. No, no, no. He was very, very honest. And therefore, so a perush, a psak halacha that is not halacha is still Torah. And that's why shivim panim no Torah, we have the ability to reach a Kadosh Baruch Hu differently. Chazal say, kishem shein partzufei andamot, none of us look alike. Why? Because our deot are different. We have different opinions. And boy, do we have different opinions. That we all know that. I always comment in the Tfilah L'Shlom HaMdina that we say on Shabbatot. This morning we said it in Shul as well. So it says, Ushlach Orcha V'Amitcha L'Rasheha Sareha V'Yotzeha. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to send his guiding light to the leaders, to the ministers, and to the advisors. There's something missing there. It doesn't say Toshaveha, it's residents. But it doesn't have to say it. It already says Yoatzeha, it's advisors. We have 6.5 million Jewish advisors in this country. So everybody's a Yoetz, Lememshala. Everybody has a Deya, has something, an opinion to say. But Chazal value that. That's why we're all we look different. So that because it expresses the fact that we see things differently, which means there are different pathways to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, while there are common themes and common denominators, but no two Jew meets up with HaKadosh Baruch Hu identically. And that is very, very important. That's why Shivim Panim La Torah. Shivim Panim is a concept of universality. It's across the board. Shivim Safot, the 70 languages, according to Chazal. So too, Shivim Shemot Yerushalayim. So we say Yerushalayim. What does it mean to you? Well, it most probably means different things to different people. And that is legitimate. Very, very legitimate. And what the Shivim Shemot, the 70 names, do is they give expression to different facets and different angles of what Yerushalayim is all about. So I'm just going to pick up on a handful in the course of this year. One is Klilat Yofi. It's found in the Hoshana that we say on the second day of Sukkot, representing the letter Kaf. And Archie has it here somewhere too. I don't remember exactly what line. But Klilat Yofi means the epitome of beauty. The epitome of beauty. Somewhere in the top, no? Yeah, it's on the third line. It's on the third line. It's the third and fourth word. Klilat Yofi. Right. So it's there. Thank you. Yeah. Mark Twain toured the world in the 19th century, came to Palestine, and he wrote this was the low of the low. Nothing grew here. Everything was desolate. And he just had a very depressing report about what this country was all about. Now, summing it up in one word, the Torah uses the word shmama. We read about it in Bechukotai. So Ramban tells us, you know, you think that, oh, Nebuch Eretz Yisrael is going to be shmama, it's going to be desolate and that. Ramban says, you know, that's not such a klala, that's not such a curse. It's actually a bracha. Why? Because, oy vavoy, if another nation would have succeeded agriculturally in this land. Kadosh Baruch Hu let the land lay fallow and desolate, so that when Am Yisrael returns home, it will be the sign, the absolute sign, that we are coming home. Do you know that Gedolei Yisrael studied all the laws of the Torah, whether they're relevant or not relevant? The Rambam especially wrote on everything. Two of his 14 books are on Beit HaMikdash concerns. And the whole book has to do with the agricultural mitzvot, which he, in Egypt, in the 12th century, there weren't all that many practical applications to Leket, Shikha, and Peya, and Shemitah, and Yovel, and so on. Here and there, some Havlachot, but not many. And yet, and therefore, in the world of Shelot u'Tshuvot, responsa literature, and that's really the litmus test to see if something is halacha lemaisa, if something's on the table, the people are active, are they performing this mitzvah, and not just a theoretical discussion. Theoretical discussion, the Beit Midrash is loaded with svarim on what they call navalei, chidushim. Beside that, so Reb Chaim from Brisk, you know, wrote chidushim also, but he wasn't writing halacha lemaisa on issues of Beit HaMikdash or on Trumot de Masrot. These were theoretical concerns. The first time the world of Shelot u'Tshuvot in the modern sense receives some attention is in 1889. The Yishuv started here in 1882. There was Petach Tikva and other places that started, the Ema Moshevot. So all of a sudden, it hit Shemitah in 1889. They didn't know what to do. If we stop working the land as the Torah ordains, everything we just put in, all our kochot, all our efforts, going to go down the tubes. And it's, you know, very easy to say, one second, the Torah says, v'tziviti et berchati, it's going to be fine. It's not so simple. When you're having that level of Mesirat Nefesh to build up a yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael from scratch, literally from nothing, and they didn't know what to do, so they turned to the Rabbanim, and even the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael at the time were scratching their heads and stroking their beards, exactly what to say and how to do this. They ended up calling upon the Rav of Kovna, Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan. Those of us who studied in Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzhak Elchanan, which later became a Yeshiva University and so on, the Rav of Kovna, he wrote the Haskama, the approbation for the Chofetz Chaim's Mishnah Brura. So he was the Paisik of the 19th century. And he is the author of what's known as the Heta Mechira. I'm not going into the whole issue of selling parcels of land to a non-Jew and bypassing and so on. The question is, why did he do it? Because he understood something. There had to be a response, an immediate response. So he said, this is a one-shot deal, and after 7 years, we have to review and see again. He died this 7 years later, 1896, but the Rabbanim keep reviewing it until now. They keep reviewing it, and they still think we still need it. But in a Shir on Shemitah, you'll find out that there other ways of observing Shemitah, with or without the Heta Mechira. But I'm pointing out that it was only until 1889 that a practical Shaila came to the attention of Rabbanim. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed us with the revival of the land. So the Gemara tells us in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Zayin, the order of our daily Shmoneh Esrei, in the middle, when it goes from personal requests of da'at, chonenam da'at, and tshuva, and atonement, and health, these are personal issues. And then you get to barech aleinu, which is parnasa. That seems to be personal as well, but the Gemara sees it not in a personal sense, sees it as the transition to the national requests, which tack on to tika b'shofar gadol l'cheroteinu, which is the ingathering of exiles, kibbutz galiot, and then ashiva shofteinu, which is the revival of the Sanhedrin, until the Yerushalayim Mircha, the rebuilding finally of full Yerushalayim, and Tzemach David, the coming of Mashiach. So the Gemara says this is an order, there's a chronological sequential order that we have here. So the Gemara tells us in Masechet Sanhedrin that Ein Lecha Ketz Megula Mizeh. If you're really looking for a revealed sign that we're on the road to recovery, to national recovery, to redemption, Ein Lecha Ketz Megula Mizeh, as the pasuk says in Yecheskel Perek Lamed Vav, Vatem Harei Yisrael An Pechem Titenu Ufer Yechem Tisu La Mi Yisrael Ki Kervu Lavo. Check out the agriculture. If things start growing, that means the Kadosh Baruch Hu is turning to us. And indeed, many of you have heard from the beautiful thought of Rabbi Sholem Gold. He said it here in this room 1,000 times over, and some of you heard it elsewhere. But he said, if you want to talk to God, go to the Kotel. But if you want to see God, go to the Shulchan Machne Yehuda, and you see all the fruits and vegetables, because that's where Kadosh Baruch Hu has revealed himself in terms of what has happened to this country. And Baruch Hashem, and with only 3% of Am Yisrael engaged in agriculture, there's more food on the table now than in the days of Shlomo Melech. So that doesn't mean there aren't people who still need, and we have to look out for needy people and hungry people. But by and large, this country has solved the food problem beautifully, and I would even say miraculously. And it's all part and parcel of the Mevarech HaShanim, that bracha, which leads into Kibbutz Goliot, which, Baruch Hashem, we're in the process of that too. And you know that in about 10, no more than 15 years from now, majority of Am Yisrael will be in Eretz Yisrael. It's going to be a great day for Am Yisrael. So Klilat Yofi means the epitome of beauty. So Mark Twain didn't see it. Look, I might be a little subjective, but I do travel the world, and I've seen very beautiful cities. Last week I was in St. Petersburg, Russia, and it's a beautiful city, no doubt, a lot of palaces and so on. There's something about Yerushalayim that's indescribable in terms of its beauty. So again, you say beauty is in the hand of the beholder, but something objectively very, 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 very attractive to Yerushalayim. Thank you very much. Very, very attractive to Yerushalayim. And in 1908, thank you. In 1908, when Rav Kook was here in Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim didn't look like it looked like now, as you know. It was still but the Ungarin they were building to build in the Meir Sharim area, outside the Chomot. The city was, the old city was really not really built up at all. And it was, in Hebrew we call it aluv. It was just not nice looking. And in that year, there was the founding of the Bezalel School of Art. Now, Bezalel School of Art today is internationally renowned. It's part of the Hebrew University. It's an academic institution. So Rav Kook was asked to send the bracha, the opening of the Bezalel School of Art. And Rav Kook was a visionary. And he writes about Klilat Yofi, about the value of starting a school that its intended purpose is to cultivate the sensitivity to beauty and aesthetics. And he believes that Yerushalayim requires such an institution of art. I'm not 100% sure that Bezalel ultimately functioned the way Rav Kook saw it, no different than Rav Kook's beautiful speech at the opening of the Hebrew University in 1925 on Mount Scopus, on Torah Umada. You'd think that Hebrew University was going to become Yeshiva University, but it didn't become that, but it became something else, good, nice, very good even, but not what Rav Kook intended. But nevertheless, the letter that he wrote in 1908 to the Bezalel School of Art is very telling, because he speaks of an analogy of a three-year-old girl who's very, very sick, high fever. The parents are very worried. The doctors are very, very worried. They don't know what to do with this girl. And she's just doesn't get out of bed. She has no simchat chayim. There's no joy to her life at all. And she has no activity to her life. And they think this girl's going to succumb. All of a sudden, one morning, she wakes up. She asks for her doll, her booba. She asks for a doll. And everybody's happy. Wow, she asked for her doll. Now, this girl's not out of the woods yet. She's still very sick. But the doctors feel that she's bottomed out. She's now on an upsurge. She's asked for her doll. She wants to play with her. That's what a three-year-old girl does, play with her doll, not just lie there, you know, kacha. So and everybody's very, very happy. And they know this girl's going to need some time yet to fully recuperate and so on. But the very, very turning it around, that was a very significant moment. Rav Kook said in 1908, we're bottoming out. We're turning it around. And Yerushalayim has to become Klilat Yofi once again. And it will become important for people to develop an aesthetic eye for what we do here in Yerushalayim. Let's build Yerushalayim with the factor that it should be a beautiful city. And to a certain degree, you know, I think we are in that direction. We are in that direction, no doubt. You know, sometimes, you know, we'd like to see it a little cleaner. Sometimes we'd like to see it this, that. But that's because the national sport here is to be critics. But perhaps we should just become Hasidim of Rav Levi Yitzchak from Berdichev and look at the cup that's half full and not the cup that's half empty. And just appreciate what we do have, and what we do have is absolutely phenomenal. Now, beyond Klilat Yofi, many of the 70 names of Yerushalayim actually reflect three basic themes of Yerushalayim that can be found in the Tillim in source number 3 on the bottom of the first side. Perek Kuf Kav Bet. And this Shir HaMaalot, it's the second in the series of the 15 Shir HaMaalot, and that's not an accident. There were 15 steps, each plateau, walking up to Har HaBayit from the southern end, you had 15 steps. On each step, you said another Shir HaMa'alot, and you were ascending. And you got to a plateau, you rested, you moved. So you think there's going to be escalators? No, it won't be escalators. You're going to have to walk up to Har HaBayit. Well, maybe they'll make an elevator escalators anyway. And Beit HaGadol will have to find a way to bypass the halakha that it's that's aliyah l'regel. They didn't say aliyah l'regel for no reason. L'regel means by foot. You walk up to Har HaBayit. But, you know, all right, so even if somebody gets up there with a with an elevator or escalator, maybe the person might not be in fullest fulfillment of that mitzvah of aliyah l'regel, but being there is still going to be significant. So here, the David HaMelech is anticipating. Remember, David HaMelech didn't build Beit HaMikdash. He locates the place for Beit HaMikdash. That was very important. You ever notice that in the Chumash, doesn't say Yerushalayim not even once? Yerushalayim is mentioned in Tanakh over 150 times. But in Chumash, doesn't say once. There's a remez. There's Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. Hotzi Lechem V'yayin. So maybe that's Yerushalayim. By the Akedah, El Eretz HaMoriah. Maybe that, it doesn't say clearly the name Yerushalayim and its absolute location is not mentioned explicitly in the Chumash. Why? Because, and the Torah, in Sefer Dvarim, in Parshat Re'eh, keeps saying that a Kadosh Baruch Hu will choose, which means it hasn't been chosen yet. El HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem L'Shaken Shemo Sham. God will select the place for him to reside. It will be his address. The reason is, as Ramban explains on the Pasuk in Parshat Re'eh, L'shichno tidrishu, you shall seek out the place, uvata shama. And this is something that our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik spoke about a million times, that kedusha in halakha is based on human action. If we don't bring about the onset of kedusha, it won't become kadosh. And kedusha means singling out something of the created world for the exclusive use of a reason of service of God. So that's called kedusha. It can be a place, it could be a time framework, it could be clothing, it could be a thought, whatever it is, it can become kadosh. And the kadosh baruch hu, God wanted that we should sanctify a place and figure out where a kadosh baruch hu had in mind. And it was David HaMelech who does it. He's the one who succeeds. With the counsel of a Navi, by the way, he doesn't do it all on his own. But with the counsel of a Navi, he does receive the approbation that this was correct. This is the place. And do you remember on Chag HaSukkot, in our Birkat HaMazon, we say, HaRachamanu Yakim Lanu Et Sukkat David HaNofelet. This is based on a pasuk in Amos, that was the Haftarah for Parshat Kedoshim. Akim Lanu Sukkat David HaNofelet. Now why Sukkat David? It was Shlomo who built the tabernacle or sanctuary of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So the Rav said, because David HaMelech located the place, and therefore it's already given his name, Sukkat David. And that is very, very important. So David HaMelech actually accomplishes a few things here. One is, he locates the place for Beit HaMikdash. Second, he sets up the monarchy in Yerushalayim after 7 years of Hebron. David HaMelech was 7 years king in Hebron and 33 years in Yerushalayim. Back in 1979, there was a famous speech that Menachem Begin, Alav Shalom, delivered in the White House, and it was at the ceremony of the signing of the peace with Egypt in the spring of 79. And in the speech itself, he mentions Yerushalayim. He was speaking in English, and he refers to it as Jerusalem, D.C. And everybody thought he fell off the chair. You know, it's Washington, D.C. What's Jerusalem, D.C.? And he looks around and he says, oh, you don't know? It's David's capital. And he received a standing ovation in the middle of the speech. He says, it's Birat David HaMelech. Because if you think that Yerushalayim is ours because of some, you know, United Nations resolution or because some type of a ceasefire after a particular war, that's not why we have Yerushalayim. Not at all. It has nothing to do. It doesn't even have to do with the Balfour Declaration. It has to do with David HaMelech. David HaMelech created the Yerushalayim as being the seat of Malchut, and that would be the place forever. Al kis'o lo yeshev zar v'lo yinchalu od acherim et k'modo ki v'shem kodshecha nishba'at lo Shelo yichbe niro leolam va'ed. We say it in the haftarah for end of haftarah. The idea that David HaMelech's reign will continue. And that's why Malchut Beit David is going to, the Davidic line is going to be reestablished in the Messianic days. And this all has to connect with David HaMelech and our days. And that's why Yerushalayim is the seat of the Malchut. And the truth is, another David, not exactly David HaMelech, but I will say him with the greatest of respect, David Ben-Gurion, understood that the capital of the new country had to be Yerushalayim, even though it didn't make sense in 1949. In 48, 49, it didn't make sense. Those who knew the geography and how the lines of the armistice were run and how the partition plan had it, it made sense that Tel Aviv was developing as the center city economically and it had the most population and so on. Ben-Gurion said, if the capital is going to be Tel Aviv, this is not going to work. It has to be Yerushalayim, and we're going to have to keep our eyes on the other side of the border as well. And it took 19 years of a lot of hoping and yearning and so on. And all of a sudden, it happened. It happened very quickly, for some people even too quickly. And there were even discussions during the beginning of the outset of the war, of the Six-Day War. Not all of the political parties were in favor of taking over the old city. Menachem Begin was the one who pushed it. He pushed it more than anybody else. But then it turned out that before the government decisions fell, it was already in our hands. Things happened so quickly that they couldn't even work out the politics of it. And then here it was. It was already in our hands. So Malchut is part of Yerushalayim. So you have two things. You have Mikdash and you have Malchut. Those are two mems, Mikdash and Malchut, the sanctuary, Beit HaMikdash, and the monarchy. But there's a third mem, and that's Mishpat. Mishpat means judiciary. Now, in the Beit HaMikdash area sat the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin had 70 Zkenim, another 70 here. And they had a chambers called Lishkat HaGazit. Now, the Sanhedrin functioned elsewhere as well in the process of the Churban of Bayit Sheni. The Gemara tells us that 40 years before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin already left the Beit HaMikdash area and went to Harabayit, from Harabayit to Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim went to Yavne, and then from Yavne went to Usha, to Shvar'am. It ended up in Tveria, the last station. There were 10 stations, and the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us that the reconstitution of the Sanhedrin is going to be in Tveria, and they're going to march backwards. They're going to march back to Usha and Shvar'am and Yavne, and they'll make it back to Yerushalayim according to the path that they descended from Yerushalayim. That's an interesting idea. But the ideal place of the Sanhedrin would be sitting in the Beit HaMikdash area. And the purpose of the Sanhedrin, we call it a judiciary. It's a Beit Din. But it's not really a Beit Din. It is a Beit Din. It's a judiciary for very, very few scenarios that are so rare or hardly at all. Hardly at all. The Mishnah tells us that if a Kohen Gadol was a murderer, so he wasn't judged in front of 23 Dayanim, which is the normal type of Beit Din for capital punishment offenses, but 71 would judge him. If they would be a Ir HaNidachat, a city where all of the population turned to Avodah Zarah, the city would have to be destroyed. So you'd need 71 Dayanim to judge that city. The Tosefta tells us there never was such a Ir HaNidachat. It never happened. Just like Ben Sore Omore, Lo Haya V'lo Nivra. Never happened. So you have these, I'm sorry? Drosh V'chabel Schar. It's in the Chumash. Try it on the, you can derive all kinds of ethical, moral lessons from it. But in reality, these things did not happen on a practical level. So the Sanhedrin would have been unemployed most of the time. So our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that the primary purpose of the Sanhedrin was not judicial, but rather was Torah. This was a koilel of the 70 greatest Talmidei Chachamim of the generation, and they were there to preserve the authenticity of the oral law. When the Torah Shebal Peh was not yet committed to writing, and somebody had to guard the tradition so it doesn't just get out of hand, and if indeed there would be different opinions, the Sanhedrin would vote on it. And that vote would be binding on everybody in Klal Yisrael, including those who voted against that interpretation. And if a Dayan of the Sanhedrin voted against, and he was allowed to vote against, went to his hometown and dealt with halacha as he saw against the majority of Sanhedrin, that was a capital punishment offense called Zokin Mamre, because he simply disregarded the central authority. This was the central authority of Torah, and that was the Sanhedrin. So you have now another aspect, which called Mishpat. So you think Mishpat means judiciary, but I'll show you it doesn't mean judiciary. It means teaching Torah as well. The Rashi tells us in Parshat Yitro, and this is Rashi's interpretation, Vahimi mochorat vayeshev Moshe lishpot et ha'am. And it was the next day. Rashi says, next day from what? The next day of Yom Kippur. What Yom Kippur? The Chag HaShavuot began the process of Matan Torah. 40 days later, the roof caved in and the luchot were shattered on the 17th of Tammuz. Next day, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up for another 40 days to beseech HaKadosh Baruch Hu not to destroy the people. And then it ends with the end of the month of Av. And now HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, all right, take two. Let's do it again. Psolecha shnei luchot avanim karishonim. We'll have another 40 days. And that's the second luchot. And that ends on the 10th of Tishrei, Yom Kippur. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes down after 120 days, this 340-day period, and this is when Matan Torah comes to an end with Yom Kippur. And now what is Moshe Rabbeinu going to do? He's going to teach Torah. Vayeshev Moshe lishpot et ha'am. If you translate this literally to judge, who's on trial? Who's on trial? So actually, I once thought maybe the day before Yom Kippur, there was a fight who was going to get Mafta Yaina. So there was already a dentira, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu had to litigate. But that's just a joke. Lishpot et ha'am means to teach, and it's so proven by the continuation. Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law takes a peek at what's going on. Moshe Rabbeinu is giving what we call in the yeshiva world a shiur klali, a general shiur, to 600,000 men. And the women there too, you know, listening in. You can't do this, says Yitro. Who can say, you have some people who can go to a lecture of thousands of people. Fine, not everybody. You have to break this down to small classes. And he proposes breaking it down to small classes. Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Asara, some people need small classes. And we know this in education today. So you see that the issue of Vayeshev Moshe Lishpot et ha'am was he started teaching. Moshe Rabbeinu thought everybody's going to, you know, tune in to his great speech. And Yitro told him it's not going to work. Lishpot means to teach. Needs to teach Torah. And that's what Mishpat in the Yerushalayim sense means, that it's the seat of Torah. And now you can see there are three mems. There's Mikdash, there's Malchut, and there's Mishpat. So you look at Tehillim Perek Kuf Kavbet on the source number 3. So it says Shir Amalot le David. Samachti on the bottom of source, on the first page, the bottom of the first page, under the archer note, the Migzeret Neyar. Shir Amalot le David. Samachti Baumrim li Beit Hashem Nelech. Beit Hashem Nelech. This is Mikdash. Clearly Mikdash. Omdot Hayu Ragleinu B'Shorayach Yerushalayim. We were standing, you know, firm, walking to Yerushalayim, but through the gates of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim abnuya ki'ir shechubra layachdav. Yerushalayim has the capacity of unification. Why unification? Yerushalayim was never divided amongst the tribes. It's an extraterritorial area of Eretz Yisrael. It belonged to everybody. And all kinds of halachot. For example, without getting into the gory details of nega bayit, leprosy in a house, that can only happen in one of the areas of the tribes. Can't happen in Yerushalayim. Because Yerushalayim is never considered Bevet Eretz Achuzatchem. Nobody has title to Yerushalayim. You can live in Yerushalayim, but it's not your family estate as a shevet. So you have it's a unifying call, Yerushalayim. Shesham alu shvatim shiftei ya edut liYisrael leodot Hashem Adonai. The idea was that this is the place that the tribes will ascend. The hodot l'shem Hashem. It doesn't say here to offer korbanot. Now the word l'hodot actually has a double meaning. Most popular, it means to say praise, right? From the tov l'hodot l'Hashem ulizamer l'shimcha elyon. So it means l'hodaya. But l'hodot sometimes means to confess. Lehitvadot. It's a word that also connotes confession, which means it's the place that if you sinned, you come, and that's implicit. There's a system of korbanot, korban chatat, and korban hasham that's associated with it. But it means this is where Am Yisrael comes up to Beit HaMikdash. So Beit HaMikdash, in the sense of Beit HaMikdash, is for one purpose, and it's avodat Hashem, service of God. Under the title service of God, there are certain details. One is sacrificial activity, and one is prayer. Now, the question is, which one is number one, which one is number two? We can argue that point. When you study Chumash, you think, oh, of course, number one is sacrificial activity, because that's all you hear about in Chumash Vayikra. Tefillah, all right, is almost like an add-on, a prayer. But when you open up Melachim Aleph Perek Chet, when Shlomo HaMelech dedicates the Beit HaMikdash, he gives a very long tefillah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu about what this Beit HaMikdash was all about. Not a word about sacrifices. What happened? He forgot Chumash Vayikra. He emphasizes tefillah. Lishmoa el harinam vela tefillah. Now we know that phrase from Slichot on Motzei Shabbat. Go to the great synagogue and the chazan and the choir are going to kvetch it out to the umphiest time. Lishmoya, lishmoya, elarina. You can hear it over and over again, right? Because it's the refrain of the piyut ben Motzei Menucha kidamnucha tchila. On Motzei Shabbat, we approach you. Hat oznacha mimarom yoshev tehilot. Lishmoa elarina val tfila. So you have about six stanzas there, and the refrain is Lishmoa elarina val tfila. Lift it out of Melachim Aleph Perichet. This is Shlomo HaMelech teaching us that this is what Beit HaMikdash is all about. And he says, if you have this tzara, you have this problem, or you want to come and commune with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and if you're not even Jewish, he invites the nations of the world. Do you remember many, many years ago, some of you are going to remember this from the States, certainly in the New York area. That's, for me, the States, right? The New York area. And because there were the New Yorkers, and then there were the outsiders, the out-of-towners, and you Chicagoans, you know, west of the Hudson River, you know. So there was a thing called Levy's Jewish Rye Bread. So I remember the commercials. They would have an Indian fellow, a Chinese fellow, and it would say, you don't have to be Jewish to eat Levy's Jewish Rye. And the truth is, you don't have to be Jewish, says Shlomo HaMelech, to come to Beit HaMikdash. And Yeshayahu echoes this for Bayit Shlishi, ki beiti beit tfila yikare lechol ha'amim. So that pasuk gives us the two a double-edged message of Beit HaMikdash. Va'aviyotim al har kodshi, you come to the Holy Mountain, v'simachtim beveit tfilati, olotehem v'zivchehem l'ratzon al mizbechi, ki beiti beit tfila yikare l'chol amim. So there's a mentioning there of korbanot and of tfila. But the final line is, in America there's a thing called International House of Pancakes. But we have the International House of Prayer. And that's what it is. Ki beiti beit tfila yikare l'chol ha'amim. So tefillah is the place where we should be for our, Beit HaMikdash is the place that we should be for our tefillah. Turn the page and take a look at source number 8 towards the bottom of the page. It's the Rambam in his Book of Mitzvot, Mitzvah Asei Hey. It's the fifth of this positive mitzvot. Rambam builds his Book of Mitzvot on two camps, the positive, the do's and the don'ts. The mitzvot tase, mitzvot lo tase. So there are 248 do's and 365 don'ts. On the top of the list, number 5 of the list of the positive mitzvot, is the mitzvah to daven. The Rambam believes that there is a positive mitzvah to daven at least once a day. Rambam is keenly aware of the fact that our sages in the beginning of Bayit Sheni, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, legislated 3 times a day tefillah. Fine. But the principle of davening, of meeting up with HaKadosh Baruch Hu at least once a day, is biblical, the Oraita, according to the Rambam. And if you take a look at the last lines of source number 8, he quotes a medrash on Avodat Hashem, service of God. Avdehu b'torato, you serve God by studying Torah. Avdehu b'mikdasho, you serve God in the Beit HaMikdash. Klomar, that is to say, Lalechet sham litpalel bo, to go there and offer your tefillot, v'negdo, and opposite it, if you cannot be there. Now, what the Rambam is suggesting is that there are two different levels of appropriate tefillah. The most appropriate location for tefillah is Beit HaMikdash. But if for whatever reason you cannot be there, So what's second best? You face Yerushalayim. But the Rambam doesn't say in his halachot, you face Yerushalayim. He says, nochach hamigdash. You face the Beit HaMikdash. So one second. As far as I recall, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. That's because you're wearing the wrong glasses. You put on the halachic glasses. So Beit HaMikdash physically is not there, but halachically is still there. And I'll prove it. Because one of the halachot of Beit HaMikdash is having awe, A-W-E, mora, not fear, awe. Mik et shabtotai tishmoru u'mikdashi tira'u. You have to have awe for Beit HaMikdash. And under that category, there are all kinds of halachot. That you have to be very, very careful. If you study the laws of Beit HaMikdash, you have to, without shoes, you can't have things in your pocket, and you have to be tahor, and so on. Mikveh, for sure. All kinds of things. To be in the location of Beit HaMikdash, it's an awesome experience. Mikdashi tirao. Rambam tells us this is binding today, with or without Beit HaMikdash. It's binding. So if you would be tahor 100% without any problems of tumat mate, and theoretically it's possible for a parent to guard a child not to become tamei mate. So in theory, if a person would be able to, you know, get himself or herself into that category, so you'd be able to enter into Har HaBayit, even into the area of Beit HaMikdash. Today, when the whole issue of going up to Har HaBayit is not to go on the area of where Beit HaMikdash, but to we circumscribe the Beit HaMikdash area. We walk around the edges of Beit HaMikdash area, and there you still have to have mikveh and other things of preparation, and some Rabbanim are against that too. Most of them, because they're out of control. And you know, you tell a person you can do this, and who knows where the person's going to start gravitating to places where it's mamash asu, it's really prohibited. So we have to be careful. But some Rabbanim think it's still good for the Jews to do. But it's a very, very awesome experience of Mikdashi Tirau. Rambam says these halachot are binding in this very day. So the fact that you don't see the Beit HaMikdash, because we're viewing it from our physical lenses. But if you put on halachic lenses, there's something about Beit HaMikdash that's still there. So if you're far away from Yerushalayim, so what does the Mishnah say? The Braita, it's in Masechet Brachot. It says that, if you take a look at source number 7, it says, Tanu Rabbanan, a blind person who can't figure out the direction, somebody who's unable, for whatever reason, to figure out direction, you have your mind to God. But then, the Gemara actually brings the following. And it says, Haya umeid b'chutz la'aretz. If you're in chutz la'aretz, yechaven et libo k'neged Eretz Yisrael. You focus your attention to Eretz Yisrael. As it says, v'tpalu elecha derech artzam. Haya umeid b'Eretz Yisrael. If you happen to be in Eretz Yisrael already, yechaven et libo k'neged Yerushalayim. You face Yerushalayim. And it brings another pasuk. Haya umeid b'Yerushalayim. If you happen to be in Yerushalayim already, yechaven et libo k'neged Beit HaMikdash. You focus the Beit HaMikdash. Doesn't say the Kotel, by the way. It says Beit HaMikdash. And then brings another puzzle. And if you're in the Beit HaMikdash, you happen to be a Kohen serving in the Beit HaMikdash, Yechaven et libo k'neged Beit Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. And brings another puzzle. And Haya Omeid Beveit Kodesh Kodeshim, that can only be the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. He also has an address. Yechaven et libo k'neged Beit HaKaporet. There's in the Beit HaMikdash itself a place that he too. So the obvious question is, why does it just say that everybody directs their attention to the Kodesh Kodeshim? Kodesh Kodeshim is in the Beit HaMikdash, it's in Yerushalayim, it's in Eretz Yisrael. So if you're in Tokyo, you know, have in mind the Kodesh Kodeshim. So the Rav said, Rav Soloveitchik said, because you can't skip from first grade to eighth grade. Kedusha comes in gradations. That's not a agadic thought, that's a halacha. Esa Kedushot. There are 10 levels of Kedusha that begin with Eretz Yisrael. So a week ago, Shabbat, I was in Los Angeles. They weren't too keen to hear that there's no Kedushat Makom in Los Angeles. It was a big surprise for them that Kedushat Makom begins in Eretz Yisrael. You know, that's where it begins. You can argue, does it begin when you cross the beachland of Tel Aviv when the plane is landing? Or is there territorial waters? And by the way, there are halachically valid territorial waters that you're already within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. But that's a discussion in itself. But Los Angeles is not there, that's for sure. It was far out. New York? See, Toronto, you didn't ask. This you didn't ask. I know. I've said that. Okay. New York, far out. So there is no Kedushat Makom. Kedushat Makom, sanctity of place, begins with Eretz Yisrael's boundaries and works inward. So the Rav said you have to conquer the next level. These are not geographic conquerings. These are spiritual conquerings. And a person in Eretz Yisrael is looking towards Yerushalayim. A person in Yerushalayim is looking towards Migdash. And you work your way up. Kohen Gadol is a superior type of spiritual entity. He's there on Yom Kippur. The Rav once said that's where the sanctity of place and the sanctity of time merge on Yom Kippur in the body of the Kohen Gadol, in the Kodesh Kodeshim. Everything, that it really epitomizes at that place. So you have this halacha of what to do when you're not in the Beit HaMikdash. So this is second fiddle. The Rambam is telling us in the end of source number 8 that the principal place of tefillah is the Beit HaMikdash. But if you can't do that, second best is negdo, opposite Beit HaMikdash. The reason why opposite Beit HaMikdash, this is derived from Daniel. Daniel was a minister in the government of Babel. And as is in politics, I know you wouldn't believe this, but other ministers were jealous. I know. You have to just think hard that other ministers could possibly be jealous with a colleague. And that's what happened with Daniel. And those ministers tried to really frame him. So the ministers went to the king and they said, you know, wouldn't it be nice to make a law that everybody who prays for anything, you know, bows in the direction of the king. Well, wonderful. King thought this is a great idea. You know, so, and anybody that doesn't gets thrown into the lion's den. Wonderful idea. Never in a million years did the king think that his close confidant, Daniel, is going to fall into this trap. And Daniel, as it was, the says clearly that he faces Yerushalayim by an open window, and he's davening. And they catch him in the act, you know. They catch him red-handed davening towards Yerushalayim. And the king says, you know, what can you do? You know, the law passed and I can't do anything about it. And I hope, you know, your God will save you. And as it was, the Kadosh Baruch Hu saves him. And the next morning they expect to see, you know, chopped hamburger in the den. But Daniel's still alive and well. And the lions are there. And the king, you know, saw really a miracle. And he threw the other ministers into the lion's den. And then they had a good lunch. Mamash, a good lunch. But what we see from there, a very interesting halakha, that why does he face Yerushalayim? He faces Yerushalayim, and that comes out in his tefillah, because that was the most important thing on his mind, praying for the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. And this is what Chazal wanted. You may have a zillion things on your personal agenda, you know, shiv and panim, everybody's got their face and their ideas. But there's got to be one item on the agenda that overrides every other item, and that is the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. And that's why we face Yerushalayim. I heard this once from Rav Yaakov Meidan, the great Rosh Yeshiva in Alon Shvut, and I suggested to him that now I begin to understand a pasuk in my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, which I think I landed it pretty good at age 13, but I didn't really understand it. Vayetar Yitzchak lenochach ishto ki akarahi. And Yitzchak davens opposite his wife. Now, we were trained to read Rashi. And Rashi says, what do you mean opposite his wife? Yitzchak was in one corner, and Rivka was in the other corner, and they all davened and everything, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu listened to the tefillah of Yitzchak and didn't really listen to the tefillah of Rivka, and that's all discussion itself. That's not the pshat. The pshat is that Yitzchak was davening nochach ishto because she was the object of the tefillah. Ki akarahi, the Torah says, because she was barren. That's why he davens opposite Rivka. The object of the tefillah, you're supposed to face it. And that's what it means, nochach ishto. And that's what the Rambam means, nochach hamikdash. You daven opposite the mikdash because that is supposed to be first and foremost on your mind when you're davening. So you have the issue of tefillah that we face Yerushalayim. Today, I have an app on the phone here. It's called Kotel Compass, and it works by location. So when I was in Chutz Laaretz last week, I had no problems figuring out, you know, what direction. Yeah, I was once on a boat many, many years ago, and Rabbi Jimmy Gordon, Zichron Lebracha, was on the boat, and in a siddur, he had a compass. That was like a real chiddush, and we had to look at a siddur each time to set up the chairs for davening on the boat. But all of a sudden, now you download the Kotel compass, everybody can know what direction. So there's no longer an excuse. But Some of you know that I have a son who's an LL pilot, and just past Tuesday, flying to St. Petersburg, I flew to Moscow, and I flew with my son for the first time, had to make a Shechianu. So I davened at 4:45 in the minyan, in the airport, you know, the first available moment you could daven. But he was busy with preparations, whatever, so he tells me he davened Shachris with 1,000 tefillin, 36,000 feet up, in the cockpit seat, in the seat. He doesn't come out, you know, he davens there, you know. Keeps his eye on the autopilot, you know, that's okay, you know. I said, good thing you don't wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, you know, like just make it nice and quick. So he told me, it says, the Mishnah says, Haya Yoshev al Hamor or Besfinad. Yoshev, it says, you're sitting, it says what it says. So Yechaven Libo, so he can't turn around, he's flying in a certain direction. So there you have your mind towards Beit Kodesh Kodeshim. But if you're stationary on the ground, you should focus. So you have Migdash, you have Mishpat and Malchut. So Malchut, as we said, was the monarchy, and Bor Hashem, we have it's not Dovra Melech. We don't have David HaMelech here in our government, but it's a lot better than what Am Yisrael had for 1900 years. And the Rambam tells us in the laws of Hanukkah that the Chashmonaim, who sent up the dynasty of the Maccabean dynasty, and he knew very well that some of the kings, the later kings, after the Hanukkah story, were really bad news. Nevertheless, the Rambam says, the Chozra Malchut L'Yisrael and the monarchy was restored 200 years, which means the Rambam says even a bad Jewish king is better than a no Jewish king. So we have to be very respectful to the fact that even if you don't like the politics of a particular party or a particular government, it's still not what we had in Chutz Laaretz. This is at least our country, for good or for bad. We're going to make decisions here, and we're going to be responsible for it. So this is Malchut on a certain level, on a certain level. I've mentioned in the various shiurim that my father, Elul Shalom, when he voted for the first time in the elections in 1996, he came out of the polls in Ramat Eshkol, and he said, Brocha Shechianu. I said, really? Where does it say in Shulchan Aruch, Hayotzei min HaKalpi b'pam Rishana mevorachin Shechianu? He says, the first time in his life he fulfilled the mitzvah, even in partial fulfillment of Som Tassim Alech HaMelech. He says, he felt it was the first time. And this is from somebody who was there at Kristallnacht in Berlin. And for him to vote for a government in Eretz Yisrael in Yerushalayim, he was just so overwhelmed with simcha that he just exploded with a Shechianu. And the Rav once told us, you're going to have a hard time making a Shechianu into Bracha Levatola. If a person really feels, you know, that level of simcha, it's a bona fide bracha. You don't need a Shulchan Aruch to tell you that you're, you know, you're joyous. So that's a Malchut. And Migdash, we daven, we hope to be closer and closer as much as we get. And Mishpat, so the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, we learned this here 20 years ago, the author of Sefer HaChinuch says, you know, beyond Aliyah L'Regel, there are three mitzvot that we have to bring things to Yerushalayim. The Masar Behema, the tenth of our flock, it says, Va'asiri Yeh Kodesh. So I remember a few weeks ago, we had a problem with Minyan for Mincha Marav in the winter. Finally, a tenth man struggled in. So I told him, Va'asiri Yeh Kodesh. He looks at me and he says, yeah, it's said about Behemot. I said, no, the Lubavitch Rebbe uses it for everything. Every tenth is Asiri Yeh Kodesh. He lifted out of the context, and it's a positive thing. It's a bracha. So you have to bring that to Yerushalayim. And the Maser Sheni, and the Netter Revai, the fruits of the fourth year. So there the Torah says, if you're not going tomorrow, and there's a problem that the fruits may spoil, so you just redeem it on cash value, and your next opportunity, you take the cash to Yerushalayim and buy ice cream. You don't have to buy fruits. Buy whatever you want, but it has to be food. You have to eat it in Yerushalayim. So there the author of Sefer Chinuch says, you see from there, the issue is not eating the fruits. The issue is getting yourself to Yerushalayim. Why? He said, because Yerushalayim, the Sanhedrin, guaranteed that there were OU centers all over the place, giving shurim on different levels for different people, on different topics. You can't miss it. You're going to find a place to recharge your Torah batteries, and that's what you should be doing. Coming a few times a year and doing that, taking a week off and doing what they call hishtalmut, and this is what Mishpat was all about as well.